I may be crazy, but welcome anyway to the Morning Edge. I'm Floyd J. Winters, and here is Augie.
Good morning, Tampa Bay. Great Scott, great Scott. Good grief, my Lord. The man is going to sue the U.S. government. Holy cow, what's he going to sue about? A standoff over expanding Medicaid in Florida escalated on Thursday after Governor Rick Scott, a Republican, said he planned to sue the Obama administration for using what he called coercion tactics to try to pressure the state into adopting the program, a centerpiece of the president's contentious Affordable Care Act, the ACA. It's appalling that President Obama would cut off federal health care dollars to Florida in an effort to force our state further into Obamacare. My goodness, he says we are already in Obamacare. According to my knowledge, the state has blocked it at every turn. Governor Scott said in a statement, the Supreme Court ruled the president could not use gun-to-the-head approaches in pushing for Medicaid expansion. The showdown in Florida is one of the many playing out across the country as Republican governors grapple with whether or how to expand Medicaid. The 10 states with Republican governors have decided to expand the program, like Indiana, but others have run afoul of legislatures or backed off from the plan. In 2013, Governor Scott admonished and astonished Republicans and Democrats that when he announced that despite his antipathy toward the ACA, Obamacare, he made the issue the focus of his 2010 campaign for governorship. It seemed unreasonable to deny the uninsured access to care. But this month, the governor changed his mind. He flipped again. This is the talk about, he talked about his opponent and Charlie Crist being a flipper. Well, this guy is a flipper plus. The governor changed his mind again, saying he had little confidence in the federal government's ability to pay the long-term costs. There's no history of denial or the government's failure whatsoever. But the man is, you know, he takes the fifth 50 to 75 times on a fraud case that he ran a company into the ground on with a $2.5 billion fine from the federal government, rightly so. The impasse over Medicaid this year has all but frozen work on a budget agreement between the House and the Senate, which remained about $4 billion apart. Well, Floyd, we got this. This guy has really done it in spades one more time. This man ran in order to gain a few votes. He told a lie. He had no intention of honoring any agreement about the ACA. He was going to go against it all along. And Cristofoli in the House has always said this is the case. And he's cheering on this ridiculous governor that we have. It's an amazing situation, Floyd. Now, you've got some stuff on the other little conflicts. There's so many out there that are running up today. But we've got the tension between the Saudis, Sunnis, the Saudi Sunnis and Iranian Shia showing up in Yemen and all those kinds of problems. And I think it's Mr. Insanity, Mr. Hannity from Fox.
It's an interesting interview between Hannity and Buchanan, both on the right, both conservative. But it's interesting about the disagreements when one of them is looking at history and one's looking at politics. So let's take a look at the two different sides, and we'll stop it and take comments. If you want to give us a call on this, give us a shout at 941-745-1490.
Pat, shouldn't it be a prerequisite that Iran stops being the number one state sponsor of terror, that they stop saying that it's non-negotiable, Israel's destruction, and that they stop saying death to America before we even sit down at the table with them?
So Sean is talking about the Iran deal that Obama's trying to work out, this treaty to...
It's not a treaty, though. It's a nuclear agreement.
Agreement.
But
Congress wants to look at it that way, that they have a right to still deny this because under the ability to deny treaties. But anyway, so Obama's trying to work out a deal to lift sanctions from Iran in exchange for Iran not building nuclear weapons. So let's hear what Buchanan and Hannity have to say on this issue.
No, Sean. Look, in 1956, Khrushchev says, we will bury you Americans. And 3 years later, he was in the White House with Dwight Eisenhower. You got to talk to your enemies. Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, came out and said, we're going to wipe Israel off the map. It was beer talk.
They've said it doesn't. Pat, that's not beer talk.
He was in office 8 years.
You don't believe them? Wasn't that a mistake we made in World War II? The only person that seemed to really understand the nature of Hitler's ambitions was a guy by the name of Winston Churchill. One guy that understood that he really meant what he said?
Sean, Ahmadinejad was in power for 8 years. He did nothing. He was a blowhard. Are we going to be frightened by words from some character?
Hey, Pat, what do you mean, blowhard? The blowhard that supplied Hezbollah rockets and other terror groups rockets to fight a proxy war against Israel? They're fighting a proxy war now against Saudi Arabia and Yemen? This is all Iran, Pat. What part of this are you missing?
I'll tell you what, Sean. In Iraq, Iran is fighting ISIS and Al-Qaeda. In Syria, they're fighting ISIS on behalf of Assad. In Yemen,
You think that the Iranians are our friends?
Sean, they're not. They're fighting our enemies. I'd rather have Iranians up there fighting in Tikrit and dying than American kids there. And the reason Iraq is in the camp now very much...
So what Pat is saying right now is he'd rather have Iranians fighting ISIS than American troops dying fighting ISIS. What do you think about that?
Well, Buchanan is right on the money. Buchanan knows the history here, and he understands that it's the Saudis that are our enemy, that we say are our friend. They're the ones who did the towers in, and they paid for it. They're the ones that sucked us into a war in Afghanistan.
They paid for it as far as financing the tower attacks.
Well, what else was there?
As far as that expression be taken both ways. They paid for it. Like you do a crime and you pay for it by going to prison.
They were rewarded, of course. And how were they rewarded? We flew. The only people out of this country that were able to fly at the time of the incident was prior to the incident, 9/11, was the Saudis in Sarasota County and those who had connections that were afraid that things would fall back on
them. Osama bin Laden's family was one of the few planes allowed to lift off directly
well, there were any,
off the 9/11.
And there was a whole group of Saudis in, trying to think, Palmer Ranch and a few other places, mm-hmm. in Prestancia and so forth, had homes there, still do, by the way, and they were the ones who allowed to fly. You or I could not have flown that day, but mm-hmm. they were allowed, and they were paid for. That was paid for by our government. Very curious thing. The 28 pages that Bob Graham is seeking exposure on will reveal this, but Buchanan's argument with Hannity is mouthing the usual Republican nonsense that Fox does. And he's up there saying, oh, they said this, they said that. It ain't what you say, it's what you do. And here we have Saudi Arabia right now bombing the hell out of Yemen. Why? Because they're afraid that the control of the southern two-thirds of Iraq and Yemen off of their southern border, in the case of Saudi Arabia's southern border, will be taken over by Shia. And the Shia are moderates. The people of Iran basically are not crazies like maybe the Ayatollah is, but they are freer people by a long shot than the people of Saudi Arabia. I mean, the killings, the beheadings, the hangings, and the stonings in Saudi Arabia go en masse daily, not once in a while, constantly. You're not allowed to see it, but they do it all the time. Women are forced to dress head to toe in hijabs and so forth. The whole thing is we have got ourselves up to our neck with the Bushes and the Saudis, and the Bushes have done it all the way back to Prescott Bush. So now we're arguing about whether to have a negotiated relationship with a country that we took down their government in 1953. They retaliated in 79 by taking hostages as repayment. 2 years ago, our CIA apologized for that, and we ended up in a negotiated situation over their nuclear deal. The Israelis want to yell, shut down their nuclear, bomb the hell out of them. McCain says bomb the hell out of them. So the conservative side of everything, solve problems with a bomb, solve problems with a war, and make it worse. This is not the fascists of Nazism. This is not anything like that. And people who use that to scare people into stupidity are mostly the conservatives. They're warmongers, and Hannity doesn't know his ass from his appetite. But that's how it is, and that's what we've got. And Buchanan is absolutely on on target. I've been watching McLaughlin Group, Floyd, for some time now. Buchanan has figured this out, and he's willing to say it. People who know what's going on with this country and Saudi Arabia know that the tax man for your gas, the guy that raises your price on gasoline, are the Saudi Arabians. And how do they do it? They've got the lowest cost of oil, and they jack it up. They've shut down oil wells all over Texas and North Dakota because the price got too high. Or too low, excuse me, to make it profitable. They know what they're doing, and they're manipulating us with gasoline and the cost of gasoline. The American public is totally dependent on automobiles and airplanes, the few people that are going to be, afford it. So we've got ourselves in the grip of a mean, vile Saudi Arabia, and they are the ones who aligned with Prescott Bush and the Nazis before World War II and pushed for the decimation of the Jews at that time and applauded Hitler for what he was doing in Germany with the Jews. So this is where Mr. Hannity has got his problems, let's put it that way.
So you have an opinion on the subject, huh,
Augie? Not a bit, not a bit.
Anyway, so what Pat is saying is that ISIS is our enemy, and the Iranians are fighting ISIS, and do they have the Iranians fighting ISIS and have Americans dying fighting ISIS? Let's listen to the rest of the conversation.
Oh, I think we need to hear that.
Hussein Obama ultimately being on an Iranian nuclear weapon with their history of being a state sponsor of terror, Trump, fighting proxy wars, threatening Israel to annihilate them and the United States. You have no problem with that.
Listen to the American head of intelligence. He says Iran does not have a bomb program as of 2013. Secondly, if they start building a bomb, we will know it. Third, Iran has made some concessions that are not enough. It makes them less able to get to a bomb.
Go back to 2012, and we found out they were far more advanced in their nuclear production and program than we ever thought possible. That's what Obama's own government said.
Your friend Bibi has been talking about Iran getting a bomb since 1992. In 2006, he said they'll be building 25 bombs by the end of the decade.
Patrick Buchanan, you don't have any concerns at all about sitting down. By the way, there's a big difference between the Cold War and the Russians that had nuclear weapons and America paving the way for them to get nuclear weapons, considering, I would argue, that before any negotiations take place, Pat, mm-hmm. I'm not against negotiations, but first you have to change your behavior.
Yes, you are.
Behavior. Stop being a state sponsor of terror. Stop fighting proxy wars. Stop funding groups like Hezbollah and other groups.
Poor Pat, he's got to put up with that nutcase.
In Syria, in Iraq, okay, the Iranians and their allies, Hezbollah, the Shiite militia, who are a dreadful bunch, Assad, are fighting ISIS. They are fighting Al-Qaeda. The Houthi rebels in Yemen are fighting ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
And how ironic that we're serving as their air force in those instances, in large part.
Who are they killing, Sean? They are killing our enemies.
Okay.
Iran is killing our enemies. It's just that simple.
It is that simple. I mean, this doofus nonsense coming out of Fox because of these clowns, Hannity and others, Fox and friends, if you will. I mean, jokers big time. We have a caller.
And then we're also fighting against them in Yemen with the Saudis. So explain that logic to me. How is that a
comprehensible foreign policy? I'll tell you what the Saudis are going to do. The Saudis are making a terrible mistake. If they go in there on the ground, it'll be their Vietnam. When I was a young editorial writer, Egypt went down there.
If the Saudis don't go in there, then they're going to be surrounded by the Iranians, which, by the way, wants to clearly build a huge power for themselves in the region, and that would be more dangerous, as the Jordanians and Egyptians believe.
John, the reason if there's going to be a power in the Gulf is because your president, George W. Bush, invaded Iraq and turned it into an alliance.
Pat, if you're going to bring it up, point out that the surge worked and Bush's admonition
the
in
surge
2000,
worked.
Hang on, and this 2007, if the admonition of keeping intelligence and training troops on the ground were met
two
by Obama,
wars.
We wouldn't be in this position, would we?
Baloney.
Sean, would
we?
The reason we're in this position is because Saddam Hussein, a thug, was overthrown, his state was destroyed, his army was broken up, elections were held by Bush. Democracy crusade,
right,
and the Shia won.
You believe that we can make a deal with the Iranians. You believe peace with the Iranians in our time.
Of course
you
can.
No, I'm not scared of Iran, for God's sakes. They don't have an atomic bomb.
Now you sound like Obama. Iran is a tiny country. They're not a threat. Do you believe that?
Bibi's sitting on 200 atom bombs, and he's fretting over Iran.
So Bibi has How many say atom bombs? 200 atom bombs.
We do not know because they won't sign on to the nuclear peace treaty.
For those who aren't aware of it, he's talking about the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, has possibly up to 200 nukes, and we're afraid that Iran may get one.
Well, the ironic thing here, Floyd, is Pakistan has had nuclear weapons. Pakistan has a very radical bunch of Muslims there. They killed their own leader, Benazir Bhutto, assassinated her during a political campaign in her parade bus or car or whatever. The point is that if you're going to look at the Middle East, you've got to understand who the possible friends are. And when you have these extreme Salafi Mujahideen, whatever you want to call them, Wahhabist Sunnis, which is what they tend to go to, which is the most extreme aspects of Islam, run by Saudi Arabia, who buys all the mosques in the world with a mortgage that says, we decide who your imam is going to be. There's no chance these mosques won't have a stirring up of hatred of the West coming out of Saudi Arabia. And every time the administration or the conservative leadership comes up with something, our friends, the Saudis, and the thing that Hannity comes up with, well, they're what was the term he used for the Iranians? Their world plot to for terrorism, baloney. If you look at the map, and you need to do it, 2/3 of Iraq are Shia, most of all of Iran are Shia. The Shia Muslims, they're moderates. That is a physical positioning and a fact of the nature of these people, and they do commit acts of terror upon the people they find enemies from within. But they're not nothing like the Saudis do. In any event, Ahmadinejad, which is what Pat Buchanan was talking about, was nuts. For 8 years, he spouted the worst aspects of Islam about the West. And he got kicked out, and Rouhani, who was very little known, but known on the Internet in Iran, was put in as president, and he's the one that led the negotiation. He's the one that's reached out, and he represents the people. And when the deal was agreed to, that they were going to continue it and go further, the cheering in the streets for the deal, the lifting of the sanctions, and the opening up of the West and the Internet is what those children, the young people, were cheering in the streets wholesale, everywhere. So this nonsense that Netanyahu is a warmonger comes to our Congress to divide this country some more. We don't have enough division here, do we, Floyd? And here you have Israel representing 5 million people coming to a country of 350 million, telling them, yanking their chain of the Republican side of the government, and they jump like dogs. I mean, he's got to think we're stupid to have leadership that would then write a letter with 47 signatures, of which some of the people who signed on to that have now apologized for as being stupid, to divide this country against itself over a deal that none of the other five signatories to the deal on the lifting of the sanctions agree to. I mean, it's Britain, it's Russia, it's
China,
all these people.
Germany, the major countries that are players in the world scene have signed on to this deal. And now we want to reject it.
We can't do it by ourselves. Anyway, our Congress has to agree to lift the sanctions here. But it doesn't really matter, Floyd, because those countries that you just stated are going to lift the sanctions with or without us. So we're going to look like jackasses because we walked away from a very good presidential leadership on this thing and embarrassing our Secretary of State by this conservative thing that doesn't believe in government, doesn't believe in big government, doesn't believe in talking to people, doesn't believe in solving problems, would rather use our military to solve every day. Why just, let's turn this over to a military dictatorship, Floyd.
Well, the interesting thing is, good they God. Are the first to want to go to war, but the last to want to have peace treaties, and the serve as well. They're the first to want to go to war, but the last to want to negotiate and have peace treaties. There's absolutely no disputing that.
So many of the Republican leadership have bailed on, and they're old enough to have been possibly drafted into Vietnam and escaped it. Cheney, five different excuses he put forward. And Bush
as well.
Bush, he stayed in the National Guard, but he faked his location several times in Alabama and in Texas. He was here, he was there, he was everywhere, he was nowhere. And all this behavior of what I would call unpatriotic 90-day wonders, you wonder where they're at, and you know they're nowhere. But when the time comes to spend money, they want to spend it in our military, which is close to $1 trillion, the unknown budget of the CIA, and the $700 billion of the Pentagon itself that we know about, or we think we know about, and we're going to, and to pay for more spending there and cut taxes for the wealthy, the 1%. What are we going to cut? Well, we're going to privatize Medicare.
Let's get back to Iran, though, we're still here.
All starts with Iran, where we're going to make peace, save ourselves some military spending, and get ourselves out of the middle of the... And the Iranians are doing, as Pat said, they're doing the fighting. Their men are dying. They're willing to do it. Because Iran will actually be the restoring of the old Persian Empire. That's what's going to come out of this. But that ain't all bad.
Okay. As we finish up, we're getting close to the end of this debate between Hannity and Buchanan. Hannity wants basically to bomb Iran along with McCain. And Buchanan's basically saying, we had Khrushchev that threatened to take down the United States, but within a couple years, there he was negotiating and meeting with Eisenhower in person. And we've had a situation where our enemies have become our friends, whether it was Germany and Japan from World War II, or even Russia, the thawing of the Cold War relations. Let's see what's going to happen here.
Which hasn't even produced weaponry.
And this is going to create an arms race that the likes of which the world has never seen before.
One
decision, Pat. Now you're putting nuclear weapons in the hands of radical Islamic mullahs. You really want that? You don't see that as a danger?
The United States could finish off Iran in an afternoon. What are you frightened of, Sean?
Okay. Well, I think it's a bad idea. Just like we finished off North Korea in an afternoon,
and I think we can stop it.
I think you're dreaming. All right. Thank you, sir.
I think you're hysterical, Sean.
Well, I really fall in Pat's camp here, because this really demonstrates. Here, Pat is essentially what I would call close to being a true conservative, who understands the nature of government, understands the nature of negotiation, doesn't believe in going to war, much like the conservative Rand Paul, libertarian. And so you have some people on that side of things have got some reasonability. But here you have Fox beating the drum with some of their clowns for war. But we've got a call coming in later in the next few minutes with Dennis Mailey, who's going to talk about politics and what's happening in the state, probably about Scott and his flip-flopping again. But if you have interest in the show, this is going to be an interesting conversation as well. We're going to be talking about the Confessions of a D.C. Madam, and with the co-author Nick Bryant on Monday. And we've got a few more interviews coming up, but and after our break, we'll be going to the interview with Dennis Mailey, hopefully.
Okay, I guess that was a hint for our break.
There you go.
Sarasota is home to a true gift, the Posture Clinic of Sarasota, with Dr. Mark D'Amato, 4450 South Tamiami Trail. Dr. D'Amato is a veterinary chiropractor, treating horses, dogs, or your favorite four-legged friend. First and foremost, animal chiropractic care is not intended to replace traditional veterinary medicine. Complementary care is a type of care that works with your vet, and certainly not instead of them. To find out more information, call Dr. Mark D'Amato at 941-927-7009. That's 941-927-7009. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mark treats two-legged patients, too. With the animals. With the
animals. And we are back on the Morning Edge, and we have our guest, Dennis Mailey, from the BradentonTimes.com.
Online.
Online, but it's online. And Dennis, welcome to the Morning Edge. Did I get your website right?
Yes, sir. www.thebradentontimes.com. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, Dennis, you wanted to talk about politics, I understand.
Well, I'll tell you, I listened to the first half of your show, and I managed to probably get by the last 2 years without hearing any Sean Hannity, which was wonderful. But you interrupted that peacefulness that I had been enjoying. But I was good to hear this new narrative. That's the first time I heard the whole idea that the war in Iraq, those nearly 10 years was a success, and the surge worked, and it was just the drawdown afterwards that have led us to our current predicament. So I guess that's what we're going to be hearing in the 2016 elections, that no, what are you talking about? You know, the Iraq war was a complete success, and it was only our drawdown after George Bush left that, you know, led to our current dilemma.
Well, we lost 4,000 men. We lost $1 trillion of our national treasure. We lost tens of thousands of wounded. We destabilized the country. There used to be Christians in Iraq. There are no longer Christians in Iraq. They've been chased out of there by ISIS. We've led to the turmoil that's caused this founding of an Islamic state. All of that is a consequence of Bush's invasion of Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11.
Obviously, you don't love America. and you don't support our troops either.
I support our troops. That's exactly why I made the statements
well,
I made.
I agree with 1,000% of being facetious.
Oh, I understand
that. I was one of our troops.
I understand.
I was fortunate not to have to. I got out of the Army right before the invasion of Afghanistan. But I did say back then, I think Pat Buchanan hit something really square on the head. When he said, we got rid of the thug, we gave him democracy, but the Sunni won. I said way back then, I said, if you think that you can't end up with someone worse than Saddam Hussein running Iraq, or a worse situation for then, or a day that we might look back and say, long for the days of Saddam Hussein and the stability that was in that region.
The Iraqis feel that way. They long for Saddam Hussein
right
now.
Yeah, you're not paying attention if you can't imagine that. So what we have is a scenario where you can always get worse than you start out with. There's a great writer who I love to read, a former CIA agent or CIA analyst who later came out against all of our policies. And his name is Chalmers Johnson.
Yes.
And he wrote the book Blowback, and of course coined that term that we heard so much in Iraq and Afghanistan with the fact that we had trained Osama bin Laden and a lot of that Mujahideen that we had trained and lent support to Saddam Hussein when he was at war with Iran. And he looked at that, and in his two books, that one and Sorrows of Empire, he really documents our audacity and our perpetual failure in trying to install puppet governments that we think are just going to be friendly to our interests. We have done it, but more often than not, it has been an unmitigated failure. And it's led to many times more problems, and that's what we have now. We thought, if you go back and read the true history of what was happening at that time, we did think that we were going to very quickly and very easily depose Hussein, which of course, we pretty much did. But where we really erred in our ignorance of the region is we thought it was going to be simple to go in and put up a puppet government to hold elections real quick. We were supporting Chalabi at that time, and we poured tons of money into the Iraqi National Congress, who staged those false pulling down of the statues and all that when they weren't even Iraqis. And when we did that, we thought, we were going to go in and overnight put our person in there. And when it didn't turn out that way, we learned that hard lesson. And really, this brings me to an interesting point, because the last couple of weeks, my son and I, Sullivan, who's 11, we've been reading some dystopian novels. He read one for school this year called The Giver by Lois Lowry, which is a real good one written in the 90s. And
is
then
that the
started
one
getting.
They made a movie from.
They did. Yeah, we watched a movie afterwards, and then he started getting into a couple of the other ones, like The Hunger Games. He read those a couple of years ago, and then he read all the Maze Runner ones, which are kind of modern dystopians. And I said, I think it'd be really neat if we read some of the old ones that I grew up on. And we read Animal Farm, and now we're reading Fahrenheit 451. But when we read Animal Farm, it was
we're
just...
living Animal Farm right now.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, we were able, it amazed me how many analogies I was able to make to him about questions he had with things that are happening in the world and continue to happen in the world, and then having to keep going back and remind him that this was written in World War II. You know, this was written in the early 40s, published in 1945, and we haven't learned much from it. You know, no. We have this idea. This is what revolutions are, and regime change, overthrows. They're very sloppy and messy. We saw this with the Arab Spring. Most people, like the animals on the farm, are willing to revolt if they don't like their situation, but they're not capable or willing to do the hard work after the overthrow. And the people that are typically aren't doing it for altruistic reasons in that power vacuum. And time and time and time again, you end up with just a different version of what you have. Because as Lord Acton said even before Animal Farm, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Well,
haven't seen a good revolution. I think the only one that you could point to, and it didn't have a long-term success that you could say was tremendous stability, but I think you'd have to look at South Africa to see one that was kind of an exception to the rule.
Yeah, the apartheid. You know, the thing that ironically I think happened was that when you have two-thirds of Iraq as being Shia, it was an open invitation when Saddam went, who was a Sunni secularist, and all his generals were in the same category. They were Sunni. And when we disbanded their military, those guys helped form ISIS, and the money that went to that came out of Saudi Arabia. So they were terrified of Iran coming in and uniting with this two-thirds population of their basic religion of Shia Islam. And that is why they're sending in their generals, about 100 of them, to organize and go against the ISIS, and are willing to do it because what's going to happen... And we may be better off with that situation than the Saudi power, and that's why Saudi is invading Yemen, because ISIS will be kicked out of there, and the Shia will be taking over Yemen as well, and Saudi is going to be surrounded by Shia. And and guess who sits on the bulk of their oil? The poorest of the poor, the most harassed and tortured people are Shia. In all of Saudi Arabia, and the bulk of their oil is under those people where they're located in Saudi Arabia. So when you have this airplane bombing of Yemen to keep the Houthis out, they're making the Houthis out into something pretty awful. And in fact, actually, it was their government that they're restoring. But the culprit here, and Hannity wants to push the Israeli bomb Iran McCain nonsense, and this is what we've got. It's just an amazing situation.
Yeah, and it shows how much ignorance, you know. And I said years ago, it never strikes to, or ceases to amaze me how much credit we give Senator McCain. Do you remember in 2000, in 2008, when he was running for president, and everybody said, "Well, you can't." I mean, going after John McCain on foreign policy. I mean, there's nobody that understands militarism, and who ever said that? Where was that ever demonstrated?
Well,
when you look at a guy, and if you look at his history, here's a guy who should have been thrown out of the Naval Academy. He had, on several occasions, enough demerits to be thrown out.
Yeah,
but because
six crashes of trainer planes. Six.
Right. And for people that don't understand that, you don't get to crash two. You crash one, you're not a pilot anymore.
Yeah.
You don't get to crash two. So when you do all these things, and you have really a failed military career, which, you know, the thing he's most noted for is either crashing or getting shot down, and then becoming a POW.
And being the son of an admiral.
Exactly. So that time as a POW is where he supposedly earns all of his military understanding, which doesn't really make any sense. There's a lot of people that were in POW camps. We don't call them, foreign policy or defense experts. And John McCain's, you know, what he's lobbied for in his career in Washington doesn't make a good argument that he has a tremendous amount of wherewithal in that department. So anyway, one of the things I think we consistently do poorly is look at this through any lens of history. And I'd like to direct any of your listeners to a great article that we ran on Monday. And one of the good things about our website is it's very easy to find everything, because if you just keep scrolling down and hit next page and scrolling down, you'll go through every day and see the news. But we had a great special feature on Monday by Dr. Alon Ben-Meir. He's a professor of international relations at the Center for Global Affairs at NYU, and he teaches courses on international negotiation and Middle Eastern studies. So he's one of our foremost Middle Eastern experts in terms of understanding the culture, the history, and he gave me this piece, and it was a pleasure to run it, and it's called Freedom and Martyrdom. And it's really not a position piece any more than it's a very brief and incredibly well-done, concise history of that region through their lens towards the West. And he just makes the effort that, listen, wherever you land on these issues, whatever you think we should do with ISIS, you should want to understand the perspective of the Middle East toward the West. And he goes through a little bit of that history and the way Iraq was carved out of nowhere with three distinct separate cultures that really should have all been their own nation, but and you know, the way nations tend to grow successfully and organically, and instead said, hey, from here to here to here, you guys are all together, kind of like if somebody took a slice of Mexico, Canada, and the United States and said, you know, okay, you're a country now, get along. And he goes through the creation of the State of Israel. He goes through the wars, you know, in 68, or excuse me, the Six-Day War in 67, goes through the Yom Kippur War, and then the Iranian Revolution, and gives you an idea that, hey, listen, you know, they've got some reasons to be skeptical of us as well. So when we sit there and Sean Hannity says, you can trust these guys, you know, this is a relationship that we're on the less trustworthy side of the fence here. We probably have a lot more to do in terms of building trust, or they should have a lot more in terms of a position of saying, hey, you know, we're skeptical of you, than we do. And if we don't learn our history and if we don't approach it from a fair perspective that really, you know, respects the past, then you get those moronic type statements, and then you have millions of people falling behind saying, yeah, what he said. Because it's easier. It's easier than understanding, because it's really a difficult and complex situation that there's no obvious solution to, but that we need intelligent conversation about. And that's the part that's obviously missing. Thank God they can get it on the Morning Edge if they can't get it on the Sean Hannity show.
Well, you know, Dennis, we had a revolution, but we were lucky. We were people had been shipped out as from debtors' prisons, which we're recreating in this country for our poor. And we came here, and religion, Puritans were despised in England, and they formed Salem, and they proceeded to go after women and steal anything and everything from their virtue. But in any event, we had an invading force running the country in the Brits, who had to go up against people who aligned themselves with Indians, hiding behind trees and killing these lined up rows of well-dressed Brits to gonna maintain the kingdom. And then a big chunk of the people, when the revolution finally hit, went to Canada and ironically formed a pretty good government up there that still followed England. But as England moved more and more left, they stayed in that category of more and more left. And this country, because we have that religious background, became more and more conservative, more and more fascist, I think, in the forming of the South. The plantation mentality was oligarchs have to rule. And so when you say we have revolution, now we're in a position of the oligarchs running our elections, and we're in a position of looking at that as, well, let's revolt against this. The people who could win that pretty easily in some circumstances of rigging of elections and so on, are the ones who would follow the oligarchs and take us into something far worse.
And they're aided more than any funny business in the elections. They're aided more by ignorance, you know. I've said for a long time, money's a silver bullet, but money only works when people don't pay attention. The billion-dollar campaigns don't work if everybody's informed. The little simple ads, over and over, vote for this guy, don't vote for that guy, the name recognition, you know, correlation with who wins elections, it only works in countries like ours. When you look and you say, why don't they spend so much money in other countries? Well, because you can't influence it if people know the score. And, you know, that's the other half of the equation, is that until more Americans, take the time to pay a little bit of attention, to follow along, to create informed opinions about these very important issues that we're facing, then the money is always going to win.
Yeah, and when you get into conversation with people, well, you're a liberal. What You're a conservative. You're what does it mean to be a liberal? What does it mean? People don't even know what those
No, and that, and those perspectives, yeah, they're so muddied in really what you got to say is do you not pay attention and vote the party line for D or R, or are you a thoughtful, pragmatic intellectual who likes to, you know, study the issue, explore the options, and come up with something more intelligent. But listen, while we're on the topic of elections, today's column, I've got Marco Rubio and the false call of higher office. And the last two Thursdays, I've been talking about this really, you know, whether you like him or not, there's a very deep bench of Florida Republicans who have, in all likelihood, a very bright future in politics. And last week, you know, I talked about at the time, CFO Jeff Atwater was just about to announce, he'd already been telling his financial backers, he was about to announce that he would be running for Marco Rubio's Senate seat, and he was planning his announcement for right after Senator Rubio's announcement on Monday. Of course, he shocked everybody early Monday before Rubio's announcement by saying, I will not be seeking that office. So that kind of sent everybody scrambling. Because what you have a unique situation at the state level. You have all of the cabinet members, all three, CFO Jeff Atwater, Ag Commissioner Adam Putnam, and Attorney General Pat Bondi, all getting termed out. They'll all have completed their two terms in 20.
So are we going to have a primary with all these people fighting for the Senate job of Rubio?
Well, I don't know. And the thing is, so now have Atwater. And Atwater is a very moderate and very reasonable Republican. He stopped by my office this year when he was going around campaigning, and we had a good conversation. You know, he's one of those guys that, you know, the CFO, he kept everybody from Sink's team that he could. He acknowledged, he said, we have a great CFO right now. You know, she happened to be a Democrat, and we great people that, you know where all the light switches are, and we want to have continuity and just maybe improve where we can. We talked about, you know, he's done a lot of good insurance reform, but not enough on the other side. And we talked about the challenges with the legislature. You know, he's moved the ball, and he's a person that doesn't die on the hill, but looks at it and says, what can we get done, get voting, and get through that'll be good, you know, for the average Floridian, and let's try to get it done. You know, and that kind of reasonableness, you know, some of the extremists on both sides don't like it, but I've always liked pragmatists. But so him dropping out sends a big cue up there, because we've also got the governor's mansion will become open. So popular wisdom was that you know, maybe Ag Commissioner Putnam would be looking for governor. I still think that was the case, but there was rumors not too long ago that Rubio was going to look to run for governor of Florida in 2018, and I actually thought that was a great political move for the senator. And the reason is, I don't think he has the proverbial snowball chance to get the Republican nomination. I don't see it at all. And I recap in the column today how amazing that is when you consider that he was the star of the 2010 election. He was the one that they put way out in front. And, you know, they called it the Tea Party Revolution, and, you know, they put Marco Rubio up, and even by, you know, he continued his ascent. Remember, it was only 2013 when he was on the cover of Time magazine with the words, the man, well, the savior of the Republican Party. So he was, you know, and you even had former President Clinton saying, you know, he's someone that the Democrats really have to look out at. So his fall from grace, from 2013 to 2015, where people really didn't even have him on the radar, was pretty pronounced, and it really all fell down to one misstep. And that's the irony there, is that the people that kind of lifted him up were the people that were about to tear him down, and it was just in a very conservative, but not quite line in the sand enough, immigration overhaul proposal. Mm-hmm. And you remember how the Tea Party just tore him apart because they were calling an amnesty for illegals, and that seemed to be the end of Marco Rubio. But he's rehabbed his political career a little bit, and even though he's kind of, you know, he's down around 7-8% in the real clear politic polls, you know, he's raising money, raised $1.5 million his first day, but I don't see any place for him, because, you know, my common sense sort of dictates to me that you're going to have Jeb Bush as your establishment candidate. I think that's been pretty well determined already. And then if you're going to go against Bush, I mean, the closest with experience, and Rubio really looks kind of amateurish next Bush. Like, he doesn't have anywhere near the record. And when you hear him talk about policy, he's not nearly as wonky as Bush is. So I don't think he can go head-to-head with him. I think probably the only person that could even try that would be probably Chris Christie. But then you've got, I think you have to go far right to get around that. I think you're going to have a lot of candidates trying to say, okay, for the Sheldon Adelsons, the people that that even Jeb Bush isn't conservative enough for. But then I think Rubio's outflanked. I think that you have Senator Cruz, and I think that you have Governor Scott Walker from Wisconsin, who are, you know, going to out far right him, and are darlings of that Tea Party already. I think he kind of ends up down in the third tier. I think he ends up down there with probably former Texas Governor
Perry.
Rick Perry.
Rick Perry, yeah. Mike Huckabee if he runs again, maybe Rick Santorum if he runs again. I think Rubio ends up down in that tier. And the big difference between him and Cruz is that he had to give up a Senate seat to run it. So, I mean, for him to give up a safe seat, I think Rubio could have kept that seat as long as he wanted it. You know, when you look at how easily he won it the first time and how, you know, Republicans have been doing statewide, to give up that seat. And then what does he do if he loses? If Bush gets the nomination, which would be, you know, that's the thinking right now, he wouldn't gain anything in putting Rubio on as the other side of his ticket.
He's already
somebody
got Florida
from his own state.
Yeah.
You know, he already has the Latino bona fides with his wife and his kids and speaking the language. I don't think he needs to do that. So I think he's out then. And when you look at it, somebody said, well, he can still run for governor then in 2018. But I think, you know, it's a funny thing. Once you lose, especially in running for president, and if you don't, you know, if you don't lose well, if you kind of get blown off the stage, a lot of happens in 2 years with everything from the voters to the donors. And then I think Adam Putnam passes them out. You got to remember, Adam Putnam was like the third youngest member of Congress ever. You know, he's drifted into a less visible position as ag commissioner, but he's very, very well liked by the Republican Party of Florida, and he has a lot of big fiscal backing. Of course, local developer Pat Neal has been in Putnam's corner early, way back since his congressional days.
But he's spoken out against the firing of Bailey. He's spoken out on things that would do him harm, but I do
think... He did a little bit. He did it with soft gloves, but I think you have to go back and, you know, Democrats obviously have a lot to be angry with him about as an ag commissioner with some of his environmental policies. But if you go back to his time in Congress, he was considered extremely moderate. Mm-hmm. And when he said some things in foreign policy about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, he got attacked a little bit from the Hannity crowd. He was considered a very progressive, moderate Republican. So I think he would eclipse Rubio if Rubio was out of office and lost that nomination. So it surprises me a little bit, but, you know, you look at it, and I guess it's hubris. I guess, you know, that call of higher office, whether it's real or false, is powerful. And now you have Congressman Buchanan saying, well, he might go for Rubio's seat, too, so we might have an all-in. You would have Buchanan, again, following in the steps of his predecessor, Catherine Harris, who could have kept that seat probably until she retired, and then, as Buchanan likely could now, and Buchanan might have
There's a theory running around. Invisible primary leaders is mainstream options, factional favorites, and the invisible primary leader is by himself Bush. The mainstream option is Rubio Walker because they feel that they could maybe step in. And Rubio's speech about "you're from yesterday" applied to Hillary, but also
It was kind of tongue in cheek. You have to think it was a shot at Jeb as well.
And the factional favorites are Paul and Cruz, unelectable Cruz, and maybe Christie. those are breakdowns. These are the ones who they're going to go through the motions and try to push Bush in. I think that's going to prove to be possibly a bigger problem people have any idea about. Jim Webb is talking about running seriously against Hillary.
You know, I heard him talk on NPR a couple of weeks ago, and I did think now... My conventional wisdom says if Hillary wants a nomination, she gets it. And the biggest reason is that Clinton machine of fundraising and of putting favors and people in their pocket until they need them is very, very difficult to run against. And I just think she's going to bury everybody under the sand. But did you notice this week she met with one of our favorite Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Warren didn't seem to come. She was cordial, but she didn't seem to come away from the meeting real warm and fuzzy, and she certainly wasn't ready to back Hillary Clinton at that point. So I think after hearing Webb speak, and I don't know whether he'd ever be able to put together the kind of financial backing, unless he was able to get a lot of maybe moderate Republicans or independents.
But
what
if he gets Warren to endorse him?
That would be interesting, but I don't know that he could. You know, he's pretty much right.
What I think Warren has done is she is in the catbird seat, and she can speak to both sides from that position.
I think a Webb Warren ticket would be extremely strong.
Would that be interesting? But I think the one salvation, ultimately, the final card that will drop in the game at the time of the election at some point, Hillary announced for Medicare for All in some category of that. This whole business is castigate those who would privatize Medicare. And so you have that kind of circumstance. She pulls that card out, which I've said for a long time she probably will do, and or Webb does it for her, or Warren does it for her. Then this is, and then she can say, yes, I think the leadership over here says this, and this is where I come down, something like that. I think we've got an interesting outcome, and the Bush will have to, he's a pretty good flipper, so he might just come up, well, Medicare for All is a good idea, but what was wrong with you want to do at the most expensive end, at the very aged. Or people who
I think that's a move that Hillary's going to have to make. You know, I look at it. I'm not a big Hillary Clinton fan, I'll be honest. You know, I think she's very entitled a lot of times. I think that she thinks she's owed the nomination. And I was very disappointed with her in 2008 because she seemed to have that syndrome of, you know, I'll be anything you want me to be, just pick me. And she went so far to the right on trying to, I think, overcome the idea that a woman president would be soft on defense. She had to seem so hawkish that it really made me think, well, who is this person? You know, and I'm always wary of that person that'll say, you know, just pick me. You know, whoever you need me to be, whatever you need me to say, just pick me. Just give me the position, and I'll be your person. And she's brought that on herself sometimes. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't see anybody except, you know, Warren's probably the only person that could put a populist movement together, but you can't get the money. That's the hard part. And if you can get the money, you got to do deals with people that would make her not Elizabeth Warren anymore. So that would be the difficult part. I don't know that she could raise it on a grassroots level to be competitive.
The best thing that could happen to Hillary is for Webb to announce, for Warren to endorse Webb, to get him up on the stage and cause a debate for the primary. That would help Hillary the most and help.
Yeah, she'd have to really build an identity. Now, one person that I wrote about this a couple months ago, Mark O'Malley, of course, is going to, I think, take a stab at it. I think he's a non-factor. We don't know for sure whether Joe Biden's going to run. That could be a little bit interesting. But, you know, there's somebody who's been on my Democratic radar for a long time, and I've been surprised that he didn't make a bigger splash. I don't know if you've ever heard Christopher Van Hollen Jr., the congressman from Maryland.
Yes, Chris Van Hollen, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He is very impressive. I've heard him speak. In fact, he shouted down some of the Republican rhetoric when we were coming up on, what was the word we used for it, when the 10% across the board budget
cuts. Oh, the sequester?
The sequester, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he just called them out on how nonsensical it was. And you're the same people that brought this by shutting down the government and led us here. I thought that he did a great job. And I said, hey, that's something you got to look for in 2016. But, you know, I haven't heard anything since. And the rumor is he got on the Clinton bad side by endorsing Barack Obama in 2008. So we'll have to see.
Oh, there you go. Well, Dennis, we will talk to you on Friday of next week. And it's been a pleasure.
WWPR. Bradenton, Sarasota, Tampa Bay.
Hoggy.
On board the International Space Station, a SpaceX supply ship arriving at the ISS today, delivering the world's first ever espresso machine just for astronauts. This is SRN News.
What would an extra $250 a month mean to you? For some, it's a little financial breathing room. For others, it's a car payment, a home repair, or help with college tuition. Hi, I'm Jay Farner, president of Quicken Loans, and I've got some great news if you're looking to save money on your mortgage. All it takes is a simple phone call to Quicken Loans at 800-QUICKEN to see if you qualify for the government's Home Affordable Refinance Program, or HARP. Folks who refinance with HARP can save an average of $250 a month. That's $3,000 a year. Our home loan experts fully understand the HARP guidelines, and they'll walk you through our streamlined process. And for 5 years in a row now, J.D. Power has ranked Quicken Loans highest in the nation in customer satisfaction. And this year, for the first time, they've also ranked us highest in mortgage servicing. Call 800-QUICKEN or visit quickenloans.com.
Visit jdpower.com for award information. Important terms and conditions apply. Calls for cost information. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states and home loss number 3030.
A Tulsa Reserve deputy is apologizing to the family of a suspect who he says he accidentally shot to death when he mistook his pistol for his stun gun. Robert Bates, appearing on NBC's Today Show.
This has happened a number of times around the country. I have read about it in the past. I thought to myself after reading several cases, I don't understand how this can happen. You must believe me, it can happen to anyone.
State lawmaker, meanwhile, calling for an independent review of Tulsa's reserve deputy training program in the aftermath of that accident, and that reserve deputy is facing charges. Iraqi officials say they believe government forces have killed Saddam Hussein's former deputy, who later allied himself with ISIS terrorist Izzat Ibrahim al-Duri is the man's name. He was known as the King of Clubs in that famous deck of playing cards issued to help U.S. troops identify key members of Saddam's regime. This is SRN News. The head veterinarian for the Department of Agriculture has a dire warning for the nation's poultry industry on the current bird flu outbreak. We get more from SRN's Jeremy House.
Dr. John Clifford says the industry may have to live with the deadly bird flu strain for several years. He says while new cases should drop,